This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Disability Study Channel of New Books Network. Today, I feel very happy to invite Dr. Knight and Dr. Miller to join us to introduce their recent book, Prenatal Genetic Testing, Abortion, and Disability Justice. So first thing, I want to invite both Dr. Miller and Dr. Knight to introduce yourselves to our audience.
Well, hello. Thank you so much, Hugh, for having us on. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk about our book. So my name is Amber Knight, Dr. Amber Knight. I'm an associate professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte.
And I am Dr. Joshua Miller. I am now an assistant professor at UNC Charlotte, also in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer. So let's go to our next question. Could you please briefly tell us what's the reason you take interest in the promising field of disability studies?
That's a really great question. So I was born with a limb difference. I was born without a left hand. And I went to graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill to study feminist theory and was very surprised that despite the fact that feminists paid a lot of attention to body politics, when I was in graduate school, disability still wasn't getting much attention. And so I really kind of decided that I wanted to bring kind of a critical disability perspective to my discipline of kind of normative political thought. So that was my budding interest, and I wanted to try to integrate some of my lived experiences into my research.
Yeah, and I came into this mainly through working with Amber. We both went to graduate school together, actually, at Chapel Hill. So I'd known her for a long time before we ever thought about working on a project together. This is our sort of maiden effort at doing any kind of co-authorship with anybody ever. So it's been a nice exercise in that regard. But I was interested in questions about bioethics and applied ethics, increasingly, again, like Amber, sort of tying that in with feminist theory. But like Amber said, I mean, we didn't have, I at least never had any coursework that focused specifically on disability studies. It wasn't part of our canon. And so I just didn't have a lot of exposure to it, like a lot of other normative theorists. It just wasn't something that was particularly prominent. And so this is a really good opportunity for me to learn a lot about that literature and to engage in what seemed like a really important political issue, which, you know, often political theorists, depending on the kind of work you do, you don't really get a chance to do so much. So this was really educative for me.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer again. So then let's go to your book. So my first question is, could you please briefly talk about the reason why you choose to take autonomy as a theoretical focus point in the book?
Thank you. So the book is, you know, about prenatal genetic testing and selective abortion. And it's divide it into really kind of two sections. The first is there's a few chapters that are deeply theoretical that should be of interest to students of philosophy, for example. And then there's three applied chapters. And so the beginning chapter really wants to explain the meaning, normative value, and political significance of the term autonomy. And one of the things that normative political theorists do is define core concepts like justice, freedom, equality, autonomy, and so on. Now, this is a little bit like splitting hairs, and sometimes these terms are used interchangeably, but oftentimes they're distinctive. And so what we try to do is kind of rethink the concept of autonomy, because historically, the way it's been defined in the Western canon has really reflected the lived experiences, the values, the interests of dominant groups, right? And has really been developed from a perspective of being a kind of primal life, able-bodied man. And so we wanted to kind of rethink the concept without giving it up. And so we joined forces with other kind of critical theorists and feminists, critical disability studies scholars, critical race theorists, who want us to think about what self-governance, right, might look like from the perspective of women, people with disabilities, sexual minorities, and so on. And so we wanted to rethink or salvage the concept without giving it up. And the reason why we really value autonomy is for two reasons. The first is, especially in the context of reproductive decision-making, the first is that it's an aspirational ideal for social justice movements to strive toward, right? We really think about autonomy as being the opposite of oppression. If oppression means the absence of choices, right, then autonomy is something that we could try to strive toward. The second is that autonomy can serve as a standard against which to judge the legitimacy of government interventions in people's private lives, right? So it has political purchase in that way. So we are very clear that autonomy doesn't do the following, and this is, I think, important from a disability studies perspective. For us, autonomy does not specify the boundaries of the moral or political community, right? So, you know, even for those of us who are severely impaired, who might be incapable of some measure of self-direction or decision-making, even those of us who are severely impaired are still owed dignified treatment from others, right? So we're very clear in the opening chapters, like the kind of political work autonomy does.
So thanks so much for answer about, especially Sasha, about the complexity of autonomy in your book. So my next question is about, could you please discuss the meaning and the values of the reproductive autonomy in the age of reprogenetics?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'll say a little bit more, and then I'll turn things over to Josh for some of the later answers. But, you know, reproductive autonomy is a really core feminist value, right? So among feminists, there's a general consensus that pregnant people must be able to choose for themselves whether, when, or how they will give birth and raise children, right? And so respecting bodily autonomy, for example, is a form of dignified treatment that's owed to people in a decent society. But the advent of reprogenetic technologies added another layer. So the term reprogenetics refers to the ways in which reproductive and genetic technologies converge to influence the particular genetic makeup of offspring, right, or a child. So now not only can expectant parents make choices about whether they want kids, for example, but now they can make decisions about the type of children they can have and the types of genetic traits they may have or not want them to have. So biotechnologies like in vitro fertilization and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis make that possible. So our book focuses exclusively on prenatal genetic testing, with a sustained focus on what's known as NIPT, which is non-invasive prenatal testing. This became available in the US about a decade ago. And what it is it's a simple blood draw. A pregnant patient will go in, get a simple blood draw. And from that, they can estimate the likelihood that an embryo or a fetus will be affected by a genetic impairment, one like trisomy 21, which is otherwise known as Down syndrome. And so these technologies raise questions about whether pregnant people have the right to their usage, right? Do they have a right to use these technologies? Do they have a right to selectively abort fetuses based on the receipt of their results, right? And it just raised a bunch of questions for us through the lens of autonomy, right? So are these technologies really a means of enhancing women's reproductive autonomy? Are they a contemporary tool of eugenics, or perhaps both at the same time? We wanted to ask questions about who benefits from the use of these technologies. Biotechnology companies, for example, is it the patients? Is it the providers? Is it society? Who benefits and who might be harmed by using these technologies? And I think one of the things that makes our book distinctive is the question of what role does the government play in regulating these technologies or not, right? And you can take the technology and make it separate from the question of selective abortion or not. And so what we show in the book is that we see a really stacked deck against the choice to birth and raise a child with Down syndrome, right? Our ableist medical institutions, paltry welfare state benefits, and sexist social norms around care work all steer kind of pregnant individuals toward termination. And of course, we wrote the book right before the Dobbs decision. So our conclusion talks about Dobbs a little bit. So that adds some complications for sure. And so do prenatal non-discrimination acts. But generally, in the way that society is set up, it's a difficult decision to continue a pregnancy. And so we ultimately argue that if the intent of prenatal screening is genuinely about enhancing pregnant women's choices, these technologies have to be administered alongside medical practices, social welfare policies, cultural norms that advance disability justice. So in the absence of those measures, the rhetoric of reproductive autonomy can be reduced to a false pretense or might even serve as a smokescreen for a liberal eugenic agenda.
Thanks so much for your answer. So now let's turn to our third question about your book. So I want to invite you to discuss how medical professionals who dismiss or discredit the positive testimony about the values of disabled living can limit the women's reproductive options.
Yeah, so I'll jump in with that one. So like Amber was saying, the book is really structured so that we deal with some of the big kind of normative philosophical ideas up front. Then we have three following kind of applied chapters that sort of really try to take the reader through the decision-making framework that prospective parents of children with disabilities, in our case, particularly Down syndrome, will face as they are contemplating this big life choice. And typically that begins with diagnosis. So one of the kind of major things that we were curious about beginning this project was how the way in which a medical professional delivers the diagnosis, how that can frame and inform decisions that pregnant individuals make in confronting this decision. So there are a couple of things that we take on here. The first is a kind of acknowledgement that is a very basic principle of biomedical ethics, particularly since the 1970s. Is this notion of patients having the autonomy to make decisions about their own medical care. And an important part of practicing that autonomy is the notion that when physicians are providing them with information about a diagnosis as well as treatment options, they're providing that information in a way that is fully informed, in a way that is non-directive, very importantly, and a way that is impartial. So if that's the medical ideal, right, that we are setting out the giving you full information, accurate information about the condition, and then giving you suggestions about how to move forward in an impartial and non-directive way. Part of what we found was that for a variety of reasons, physicians were falling short of that ideal. In some cases, they were falling short of it because perhaps if they were trained in, say, an earlier generation of you know, going to medical school, medicine used to be a much more paternalistic profession than it is today. And so the biases would come through there. And often the biases would come through in part because the physicians really didn't have any prior experience with disability training. So they were looking at a condition like Down syndrome exclusively through a sort of pathology lens. And they were emphasizing all of the health complications that would attend that condition without providing a full picture of what parenting a child with Down syndrome, what being a person with Down syndrome would be like. And again, in some cases, this is because of just a sheer lack on the part of the physicians for not really knowing like what parents of children with disabilities say about that experience. They don't know anyone who has children with Down syndrome. They don't know anybody with Down syndrome. And so part of what we argue in our third chapter is that physicians enjoy what we call a kind of credibility excess. They're important people in society. In a medical context in which especially folks who haven't maybe had a college education, even if you have had one, depending on what you majored in, I was an English major in college, I don't know anything about medicine. So if I go and I ask my physician, well, what should I do under these circumstances, their opinions and even just the tone with which they deliver that information is going to carry a lot of weight in terms of how I see the possibility for pursuing one course of action over another. And so we kind of do there is we draw on the work of a feminist philosopher named Miranda Fricker, who writes a lot about epistemic justice and injustice. And we focus in particular on her notion of testimonial injustice. And this is a particular kind of injustice that she identifies when a particular group's perspective, their sort of source of epistemic privilege, if you will, is rejected out of hand. Such that their perspectives aren't being brought into that larger narrative. And what we urge in that chapter are a few things, some of them on the policy side, but two that I'd like to emphasize in particular. One being that physicians should be trained in such a way that they are exposed earlier and more continuously to those sources of information, to that testimony, in part because when people survey parents of children with Down syndrome or people with Down syndrome, they overwhelmingly report that they have a very positive outlook on life, that they're very happy with their lives, that there are challenges that are associated with raising a child with Down syndrome, but they're not because of the condition, but rather because of all of the ableist norms that make it really difficult to raise a child, much more difficult than it needs to be in our society. And so part of what we say is that, particularly for state-funded medical schools, building disability training in as a standard part of the curriculum, and actually we use the University of Buffalo as a good example of this, normalizing and standardizing that training as part of being a medical professional is something that we strongly encourage. And secondly, we encourage the full funding of the Candy Brownback Act, which would help to provide clearer and more up-to-date, more accurate information about Down syndrome in particular, but about a lot of these other conditions as well. In part because what we were also finding through our research was that the information that patients were given, unless they could benefit from consultation with a genetic counselor who could better explain the results of an NIPT test, was that some of the times the information was just wildly outdated. Sometimes it was wildly inaccurate, and it almost always strongly emphasized the negative aspects of disability and had very little, if anything at all, about some positive aspects of living with disabilities in this country. And so those are two of the major things that we focus on in that chapter.
Okay, thanks so much again for your question, for your answer, I mean, to my question. So let's go to chapter four of your book. So I want to invite you to discuss the financial barrier to reproductive anatomy, autonomy.
Great. Excuse me. So this chapter is very policy heavy. And what we're doing is we're trying to imagine, you know, being in the position of someone, let's say, who has received a diagnostic confirmation via amniocentesis that they have a fetus affected by Down syndrome. So, you know, we are firmly pro-choice and, you know, make that very clear up front. But like we said, we're also deeply unsettled by this stacked deck against the choice to continue with the pregnancy. And we saw that, you know, from listening to the testimonies of people who have been in this position, that one of the most salient factors for them was financial considerations. Now, if you look at data from like the Guttmacher Institute, this is often the case with non-selective abortions, right? With termination in general, right? I can't afford to put food on the table for another kid. And this was really amplified in the case of disability. Excuse me, I'm still recovering from illness, so I apologize for my voice. And when we looked at OECD data, which is, you know, internationally, when we looked from a comparative perspective at other advanced industrialized societies and how the U.S. was doing, we weren't impressed. So American families that have disabled members are more likely to experience bankruptcy to get out from underneath medical debt, more likely to experience food insecurity and to live in poverty than so-called kind of typical families. And we were curious, okay, well, what kinds of programs are out there? If you're trying to weigh your options and think about whether or not you want to move forward with this pregnancy or you want to terminate. And so we looked at policies that are designed to kind of offset some of the costs of heightened care needs. We looked at the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, and Medicaid's Home and Community-Based Services Waiver Program. And you know, we found many of these programs kind of commendable. They have brought many families out of deep poverty, but really Social Security in the United States sets up poverty as the norm. And so we found, you know, when we kind of did our diagnostics, that many programs are underfunded. They're scattered across multiple bureaucracies and very difficult for many families to access. And in fact, many families, for example, that might need a Medicaid waiver for personal care attendance in the home are on wait lists for up to 10 years, right? And so in sum, many prospective parents get the sense that they can't rely on government-sponsored support. And so what we propose in that chapter is a long-term care system. And we try to draw out some examples at the international level, the national level, and the subnational level to think about how to create a long-term care insurance program where family coverage would be part and parcel of the policy so that financial considerations don't loom so large in people's minds, right? We don't want the choice to continue with a pregnancy affected by disability to in any way resemble the choice to take a vow of poverty.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And just to add to that a little bit, one of the major sort of gendered aspects of this is that what we found repeatedly, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about this in discussing the following chapter, but frequently there are women, mothers, who were having to try to navigate this really balkanized system. And it becomes a full-time job. So that in addition to all the other factors that push women out of the official economy or into more precarious positions, one of the really big things with this is that it's really complicated actually to access even funded resources. And depending on where you live and the resources at your disposal, it might feel impossible, even though someone can look at it and say, oh, we funded all these things. It's like, yeah, it's true. But it becomes a full-time job, actually, for someone to try to figure this out. And so that just kind of adds to compounding that stress.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer. So let's go to the next question. I want to invite you to talk about how oppressive cultural norms shape women's reproductive desire and the horizons.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I was saying before, one of the sort of major complicating factors with thinking about the decision to carry a pregnancy to term or not, and what makes it a false choice, that language of choice doesn't really apply in a lot of ways in our analysis here, is that it often requires that people consider the possibility of raising a child with disabilities in a world where they have to ask the question of whether or not the world will accept their child, but also very importantly, whether other family members are going to accept their children, whether friends are going to accept them, the world will accept them as they grow older. And these are the kinds of choices, these kinds of questions that we think it's fundamentally unjust for anyone to have to ask about bringing a child into the world. So there are a few added aspects of this that, again, kind of bring our gendered lens into this. One is, and again, we talk about this a little bit more in the conclusion as well, you know, part of what COVID, not to anticipate that too much, but part of what COVID really illustrated was the ways in which already nascent problems in not only ableist society, but also patriarchal society manifested themselves. And so women were much more likely to drop out of the official labor force than men were during the pandemic and then in the ensuing recession. So part of what makes that particularly important for our purposes is that that's following on a very long train of trends that feminist labor economists in particular have identified for generations now, which show that women are increasingly more likely to delay career or to delay pregnancies because they're concerned about their future careers. That when women have children, if you have, say, a two-partner household, if it's a typical heteronormative household, it might be true that both men and women enjoy the same total amount of leisure time, but that women's leisure time is fractured, so that instead of having, you know, 2 hours solidly to dedicate yourself to something that's not work, you have, yes, 2 hours, but that's fractured over 15 minutes here, 10 minutes here, because you know, there's much more pressure on women to tend to the needs of children than there is of men. And that also women's leisure time is contaminated, which means that they might be enjoying a TV show, but they're doing that while they're doing some kind of reproductive care in the household. So those are all sort of patriarchal gender norms that were already present in a lot of households. When you throw in the factor of disability, again, part of what makes it more difficult than it needs to be to raise a child with disabilities is that there's this tendency to view families in kind of neoliberal terms as the sort of, you know, fiction of the sort of atomic family. So that care networks that might help to support that family, right? So friends, family members, you know, other groups If people don't feel comfortable or they don't feel confident that their family is going to feel comfortable with their child to be able to take over some of those care responsibilities, then what a lot of women are having to kind of ask themselves is whether or not they're going to completely sacrifice all of their leisure time, potentially their careers, and the service of having a child. And so while we think that having children is hugely important, it's not the only important thing in women's lives, right? And so the big thing that we're kind of calling on here is to say, well, why would people have that sort of perception? And a lot of what we see here is that there's a culture that says that, one, having children with disabilities is always negative and there is no upside to it. It's going to be horribly draining. You're going to be isolated and alienated. And the world is going to bully your child to the point that they're going to be isolated themselves. And then as they grow older, it's only going to make life more difficult for them, right? And so you get this with a lot of testimony from parents where they worry about outliving their children because they worry about what, especially if they have really heightened care needs, how the world is going to treat them after they're no longer in a position to care for them. So again, a lot of what we kind of call for in this final applied chapter is a more accurate, fuller representation, more normalized representation of people with disabilities in pop culture and in the world. But also, we really push back against a kind of maternal ideology of, in particular, what's called intensive mothering, right? And the sort of ideology around intensive mothering is this idea that to be a good mom means to completely, willfully, joyfully sacrifice yourself entirely to the needs of your children. And frankly, we just don't think that's fair. We don't think it's attainable. We don't think it should be a particular aspiration, but we also just really don't think that's fair. And so you're starting to see some trend lines on this moving a little bit. I mean, there have been at least some major sort of Hollywood or pop culture sort of references to people with disabilities in a more uplifting and agentic way. But also, you know, you do get, you know, in the kind of world of mommy blogs, so to speak, right? And on social media, you are starting to see, you know, where there's a kind of normalization of people saying like, look, sometimes this is really hard and sometimes it's really great. And that's just kind of how life is. That we think is actually a much more sort of optimistic sort of model of what mothering should look like rather than this, you know, sort of frankly, always oppressive since the, you know, sort of ideology of scientific motherhood in the 19th century, the centuries old doctrine that says, you know, women, your lives are over as soon as you have children. That only becomes amplified with children with disabilities. And so we push against both those ableist norms in this final applied chapter, as well as those patriarchal norms.
Oh, thank you so much again for your answer. Let's go to the last question today. So I want to invite you to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed and speed up a problem with the existing infrastructure of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So like Amber said, we wrote the book over the course of the pandemic, which was a particularly fraught time to be thinking about a lot of these kinds of issues. As we were working on kind of final drafts of the book, we were then into the recession from the pandemic. And then the book was already starting to go into production before, like just as the Dobbs decision was being made. So all kinds of things were changing to kind of the political economy of in particular the United States, as well as to the reproductive rights landscape in the United States. So there was a lot that was kind of going on as we were trying to kind of finish this project off. So to start with the COVID-19 pandemic, part of what that illustrated and amplified were, again, long-standing issues in the disability world, as well as in the sort of, you know, gendered workplace. So many of us saw this news coverage pretty widely. People with disabilities were much more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 and to die. In particular, people with Down syndrome were four times more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19. People who were in assistive care facilities, particularly those with heightened needs, were in environments where COVID-19 was much more likely to spread. That was also a place where the people who primarily work in those industries, right, in those kinds of care industries, were predominantly, you know, lower income women, right? And so women and people with disabilities were both really put on kind of the front end of absorbing the bulk of the medical crisis of COVID-19. A secondary component of this, of course, was the triaging of you know, how in an environment where we have a scarce number of respirators and a scarce number of hospital beds, how hospitals were making the determination of who was going to receive care and who wasn't. And a disturbing trend of, you know, hospital administrators, physicians, members of Congress in some cases, saying basically, well, look, I mean, if you have somebody who is, you know, already has, you know, heightened disabilities versus somebody who could be, you know, an able-bodied, productive member of a neoliberal economy. If you have to choose between these two people whose life you're going to save, well, it's going to tend toward the latter at the expense of the former. And so you get a lot of testimony from people with disabilities around this time saying, basically, you're expecting us, especially as we make that transition out of COVID as an acute crisis into a moment where people are saying, well, we're tired of wearing masks, we're tired of vaccinations, we're tired of being in lockdown. You know, people with disabilities saying, well, you're asking us to sacrifice our lives so we can get the economy back up and running, right? And so all of, you know, a lot of what COVID-19 did was it sort of exploded a lot of fissures that were already present that we document earlier on in the book. A secondary way in which that kind of touches on some of the gendered aspects of this project is to look at how, especially the recession from COVID, affected women. So women were far more likely to drop out of the paid labor force. They were, you know, already in precarious positions and then made even more so. So part of what we kind of argue in our concluding chapter is a way of saying that COVID-19 amplifies and makes more urgent a lot of the longer standing trends that we have been trying to document throughout the remainder of the book.
Okay, thank you again. Thanks for your answer to all my questions today. I will appreciate to learn a lot about this, I mean, disability justice and women's experience and abortion and the intersection of those different issues. So at the end of our talk today, I want to talk to my audience. I personally really enjoy reading this book, and I highly recommend all of my audience consider buy a copy of Dr. Miller and Dr. Knight's newest book, Prenatal Genetic Testing, Abortion, and Disability Justice. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.